and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about our public conversations, the values that form us, and how we might be able to relate better to people we deeply disagree with. Each episode, I ask a guest about the ideas that have formed them and what they've learned about dealing with difference. I've spoken to artists, journalists, archbishops, politicians, lawyers, playwrights, academics, and more, from a really wide range of different political, philosophical, and religious perspectives. If you listen for long enough, the idea is that you will hear someone who you definitely do not agree with, who you may even viscerally dislike. But in listening anyway, I hope we can all grow in empathy, even if just a little bit. As usual, thank you so much for your reviews and your shares, and a special welcome to the new listeners that we have gained since lockdown. In this episode, I spoke to Helen Lewis. Helen is a journalist, staff writer at The Atlantic, and former deputy editor at The New Statesman. She is the author of Difficult Women, History of Feminism in 11 Fights. We spoke, obviously, about feminism, about her parents' Catholicism, navigating online backlash, and why she looks forward to the day the British media is more representative. I really hope you enjoy listening. Helen, we're going to jump straight into the deep end. No chit-chat, no small talk, right to the heart of your values and principles. But you've had a bit of warning. The question around what you hold sacred is really just trying to surface some of the deep principles that drive people involved in public conversations, to get past, you know, the way we immediately start talking about particularities and issues and ask some of those deeper questions. And you can run with it in whatever direction you like. You can challenge the premise. You can use different language. But having had a little bit of time to think about it, what comes to mind when I ask you, what do you hold sacred or what are your sacred values?
I thought about three, which I think is about the right number to have. And the first one of those is to be kind, which is not the same as being nice, because sometimes it does involve being quite tough with people, and, you know, telling people things that they don't want to hear, but having some kind of overarching principle to it. And I think that's particularly important when you're doing journalism, because you have to ask yourself before you write a piece, you know, which might upset people, which might offend people, which might, you know, have big impacts on the lives of the people that you're writing about. You know, do I need to write this? And am I the right person to say it? And am I saying it in the right way? And unfortunately, you can't get to a place where you're not going to risk, you know, even sometimes damaging people's lives. You know, if you expose somebody to a lot of attention in an article, that might be something that they find quite troubling. You know, you might bring down attention on them that they didn't want. So you have to be quite sure about what your values are before you start to write. So that's one of them. The next one is related to that, which is to be brave. And one of the things that I think, you know, I feel very strongly about being a journalist is that that is a role that we've created in society, specifically for the awkward kid. Janice Turner of The Times has it in her Twitter bio, you know, throwing bottles from the back. It is this role that we've created essentially to allow people who aren't going along with everybody, who are going, yeah, we're absolutely sure that emperor's got some clothes on, and saying things that people don't want to see, particularly at kind of what I think of as revolutionary moments, or, you know, moments where people feel that something is very much at stake, that you have to be the person going, I know you believe this very strongly, but actually there's a, you know, this isn't true, or this isn't the right way to do it, or, you know, there's a kind of mob mentality that's going for this person. Although we believe in the general principle, this specific case doesn't illustrate it. All of those things that people don't necessarily want to hear. And the third one's a bit more personal, because I think I'm getting worse at it as I get older, which is don't bear grudges. And I think I used to be a lot better at letting things go, and I think I'm getting worse with age. So it's one that I'm going to try and think about more often. Don't become resentful. You know, don't nurse your grievances. Try to be forgiving and let go, and particularly try and be forgiving, because other people are flawed and so are you, and you want other people to forgive you. So you should try and extend that same kind of good faith and forgiveness to other people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll come back to that, because I know that there's a lot in the book about your personal journey. And one of the things I'm interested in with people who have some kind of public voice is, it sounds sort of terribly reactionary, but is character, is how, you know, how we part, you know, how do we do some good, and what are the practices that we need to pay attention to so that these voices that so shape us are, you know, as constructive as possible rather than destructive. But we'll circle back around, because I always want to wind back and give listeners a sense of where people come from, the things that have shaped them, the kind of beginning of their story, really. So I'd love you to give me a sense of your childhood, paint a little word picture, and particularly if there were any big ideas that were formative, political, philosophical, religious, that you think have made, that helped make the woman you are today.
Yeah, so I grew up in the 1980s in Worcester in the Midlands of England. My mum is a, well, was, they've now both my parents retired. My mum was a religious studies teacher, and my dad is a deacon in the Catholic Church. He was ordained when I was about 10 years old, something like that, which was a surprise to me, as I'd sort of thought he was the less religious of my two parents. But I guess being the Catholic Church, he was the only one who had the option of getting ordained anyway. So quite a lot of my childhood was spent either in church itself. You know, we had weekly mass at school, plus a service that my parents, who are also Eucharistic ministers, would always do at least two services, you know, three services between them at the weekend. So I was in and around churches an awful lot. So I think that really did shape me in ways that I've kind of reacted against, but also grown towards. I read the Bible pretty early. I just think I was one of those slightly precocious kids that would read anything that wasn't nailed down. And I remember reading it and thinking, well, this is an kind of an extraordinary document. Like, this doesn't, as a piece of literature, it doesn't really hang together. Obviously, the differences between the Old and New Testaments are incredibly pronounced before you even start to get into the sort of la-la stuff like Revelations. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And I don't agree with, I'm not religious now personally, but, you know, and I don't like reverence for sacred texts. And I'm very pleased that, you know, Christianity went through several layers of distancing itself. You know, even within the Catholic Church, my parents knew people who remembered Vatican II, the Second Vatican Council, when you stopped having the mass in Latin and you started facing towards the congregation and all of those things. And I, you know, were I still religious, that would very much be the tendency that I would cleave to, because it's about the idea that you find something that is eternally truthful without necessarily having to cling on to the exact way that people did it in either the 3rd century AD or the 16th century or whatever, or 1960, whatever it might be, that it should be a kind of living process of renewal. But that obviously, yeah, had a big effect on me. I became quite a kind of militant atheist in my early 20s, feeling that it really was the kind of opium of the masses. And then as I've kind of got older, I'm in my 30s now, I've kind of come back round again, because I see the way that my parents lived their lives with an attention to what it meant to live in a community, what it meant to give back to people. You know, we used to have waifs and strays from the parish to come over for Christmas lunch, but that was kind of wonderful that, you know, there were people who didn't have anywhere else to go. So, you know, we'd invited them over, or, you know, I went with mum and dad quite a lot when they were visiting the elderly and housebound in care homes, which is not how any, you know, 12-year-old wants to particularly spend their time. But I think it's really interesting that I'm the youngest of four, and we've all ended up in a sort of public service ethos. My brother and sister are doctors, and then my elder sister is an accountant. She's also the governor of a school for people with special educational needs. So I think that they did give us all the sense that we had to, you know, be citizens. You know, we had to be active in our communities in some way.
And do you remember a time where the religious element, whether you had a sense of God, whether it was kind of real for you personally, and then a kind of crisis or a gradual ebbing, or did it just never make sense for you on that level?
Yeah, I don't. It's very hard to remember how you felt as a 7-year-old or anything like that. But I don't think I ever felt a particularly religious impulse or religious faith. So I can't remember that I had a moment of losing my religion particularly. I just had a growing sense that this, you know, there wasn't anything inside, that I didn't believe that really there's anything after death, that it just seemed a bit hopeful and convenient, but unfortunately relatively implausible. And I think it doesn't necessarily help actually when you end up, you know, I went to a Catholic school as well, when you end up being taught stuff that's just sort of wrong because it's the doctrine. Because when you eventually find out and it gets kind of debunked, then you are tempted to reject everything kind of wholesale. I think actually if you know, I think in the West, the Catholic Church is very worried about kind of declining church attendance and stuff like that. And I think actually a less kind of rigid model would probably help, because the temptation is for people, I think, like me, just to go, well, this has got nothing to do. This has got nothing for me. You know, there's nothing here.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sort of hesitant to put this in case it, I don't think it's offensive, but one of the things I was thinking as I was reading your book is it feels a bit like feminism has in some way plays almost a similar role in your life. And I mean, I recognize that mix of affection and frustration for, you know, your place of belonging, your tribe, you know, even some of the set of ideas. Do you feel like that is kind of a valid thing or not?
Yeah, I think that's a valid thing. I suppose in some way you would think it was offensive, as if it's a religion that you believe in without any good, you know, without any evidence. It's not for me, I don't feel feminism is a sort of faith-based. There's no leap of faith required, right? It's all available to you on a material level. I don't think it necessarily makes any demands of you on a spiritual level. But yeah. I do think there is something, you're right there. I mean, when I talk to my mum about religion, she'll say some various sort of wise things like, you know, well, you don't have to absolutely, you know, it's like being in a family, you know, you don't have to like everything about your family. We'd have arguments about, you know, the Catholic Church's role in, you know, denying contraceptive access, or, you know, the way that some sort of fringe missionaries even now still behave. And she would say, you know, you have to look at things in the round. You can't seize on only the worst bits of something. Yeah. And I think that's sort of how, I think that's the argument, a strong case it's made in the book about feminism too, is it's very easy to cherry pick out the fringiest examples or to get lost in the weeds of all the things that feminists have throughout the history have got wrong. But actually, when you step back and look at particularly the last, you know, 150, 200 years, you go, this is a social movement that has accomplished an enormous amount for a lot of people. You know, there are women who are, you know, now able to be in control of their own fertility. They are now educated. They're now fulfilling their potential in jobs. It has added enormously, I think, not just to equality, but to the sum of human happiness. And I think that there, you know, for religious people, I think that's a similar feeling that then, yeah, there are bits of the history that are everything from awkward to awful, but overall it is a force for good. And I'm not qualified to rule on whether or not I think that's true anymore. I mean, in my early 20s, I would have utterly rejected that, but I haven't really thought about it in a while.
Do you have a memory of a kind of where that identity as a feminist, I want, you know, conversion experience is glib, so I won't use it. But, you know, what were the formative moments or events that drew you into that sense of, yeah, this is a movement that I can belong to, or these are ideas I can believe in?
I think a lot of that happened at university, although undoubtedly I'd been thinking along those lines before. I particularly remember reading the work of Deborah Cameron, who is a linguistics professor. She's at Worcester College, Oxford. You know, about the way that even so deep baked into our language are a kind of whole set of assumptions about what men and women are and what men and women do. I remember when she was talking about newspaper headlines, and there was a newspaper headline that she mentioned, which was "Man Forced to Watch Wife's Rape." And she was like, well, this is, you know, this is a kind of linguistically that is horrifying and fascinating that like, oh, poor old him, that must have been really bad for him. And then there are so many things when you look into language even now that are baked into that assumption that, you know, men's point of view is the one that rules, or that, you know, men are the kind of default human or whatever it might be.
There's a piece in the Times or another newspaper recently about a shark attack, a man punching a shark off his wife, 35. Nowhere in the article does it mention his age. Completely irrelevant fact, except it gives you a visual picture of the 35-year-old wife who's being rescued by her husband, which, I mean, good on him. Well done for rescuing her from a shark, but still the age thing rankles.
That's funny. And I also imagine she was probably also trying to fight off the shark. Yeah. You know, I think that's one, yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? That it will have been represented as her passively sort of dangling out of the shark's jaws while he rescued her. And actually, yeah, you know what I mean? That is a frame that we put onto that situation because it's a story that we already feel we know, you know, the knight rescuing the princess. And I think journalism is full of those stories, and so is culture. So are films and televisions and dramas and plays, that there are certain just stories, mega stories. And some of them do come from religious, you know, places. Some of them come from myths. Some of them come from more recent tropes. And I think that's, you know, that the part of my journey as a journalist has been to kind of reject them.
And journalism then, like, how much were these two things intertwined? Was it you were a feminist who happened to be interested in journalism? Was journalism really, you know, for me, the way those two things developed in your life? Do you have like a primary identity? Of course, we don't complex, but flesh it out for me.
Yeah, I think writer probably is my primary identity. And it's something that I don't understand really fully how people who aren't writers live. That sounds like a very grand and sweeping statement to make, but what I mean is, I think there's something that happens when you're a writer where you're aware that you're living through everything for the first time as material. I know that probably makes me sound like a psychopath, doesn't it? But it's something that is both a kind of coping mechanism with the world and actually weirdly a kind of philosophical one too, because you do get more of a sense of acceptance when things happen to you, because this is all part of the stuff that's going into the big stew that is your brain, that you will one day be kind of pulling bits and pieces out of in order to craft stories and hopefully things that will kind of touch other people and help other people. And that is a great consolation when you're going through really big transformative life events, that it's, you know, that you're living through them first as, you know, personal history, and you will live through them again as material. I'm always intrigued by how people who don't think like that, they must be, I think, probably more, they live probably more in the moment and more unselfconsciously. I mean, one of the sad things that being a writer does to you is you never really have an unfiltered emotion without that, oh, that's interesting that I'm feeling this emotion, sense that kind of comes through at the same time.
How much do you see being a writer as a form of vocation? I've spoken to a lot of journalists, and it really interests me that there's a real scale on people who think quite deeply and ethically about how they use their voice, and for others who think that's almost like tantamount to a misuse of journalism, that it should, you know, it shouldn't be too concerned about the good in that sense. It should be concerned about truth, but also that there's a kind of scrappy lightness of heart about the thing that is central to the project. Do you, not to sound too grandiose, but do you think about how you use your public voice and the fact you have a platform and, you know, what is it for?
Oh yeah, no, totally I do. And I think that you should. I'm definitely more in the former of those. Although my worry is that framing it like that makes you sound terribly grandiose as a person, when what you're doing really is writing kind of slightly amusing pieces about, you know, your struggle to buy a new pair of trousers. So trying to dignify it with this idea that you're engaged in some great ethical struggle is probably just going to make people roll their eyes. But, you know, I've got this at the age now where occasionally someone my age will sort of die suddenly of a heart attack or a brain hemorrhage or something awful like that comes absolutely out of the blue. And you look at their Twitter feeds, and I just remember thinking this last week, you know, what do I want my last tweet to be? And I think that's probably, I know it's maybe a weirdly obsessive way of thinking about it, but it is also quite a useful thing. Like, is this sort of petty and mean and beneath me? You know, would I be embarrassed if this was my last thing that I said on earth, was just snarking at someone about something really pointless? So to try and, you know, not let yourself down in that sense, I think, is really important. And I think people also really are really wary about the idea of being a role model. People feel it really uncomfortable. And I think particularly in British culture, because we're such a destroyer of tall poppies, that no one wants to admit to that. But I do get people writing to me and saying, you know, you're my role model. And for all that it sort of profoundly embarrasses me, I you know, I don't want to be dickish about them that and take it away from them, because that's something that I think people do find really helpful. And the stuff I wrote in the book about getting divorced, for example, people have really connected with, because it's a pretty painful thing to go through. It's also seen as being quite shameful. And it's also, I think, particularly for women, and this is why I put it in a book about feminism, you know, it's an experience that really teaches you that you're not an appendage to someone else. There's still a kind of coherent you. And I think particularly I've talked to women who got married very young, who feel that they've never had the chance to develop that sense of themselves as a kind of coherent single person. They've always been a supportive human to someone else. And for all that they find getting divorced really painful, it's also sort of weirdly liberating, which is why I think it's a good trend in society that people are getting married later. I think you should be you before you're part of, you know, Mr. and Mrs. or Mr. and Mr. or Mrs. and Mrs. Because I think it's probably likely to make the marriage more durable. Because you don't ever kind of get to 40 and think, hang on a minute, I don't actually really know who I am.
I think it's an interesting thing. You know, I'm an avid user of Twitter, slightly sort of guilty and conflicted way, like many of us. But I feel this sense of the kind of confessional public square and, you know, the selfie culture and the pressure, I think, particularly on women to overshare and feel that sometimes and feel like, you know, I won't be taken seriously if I talk about my personal life. But I do think there is something about intelligently, carefully and thoughtfully sharing some of our experiences that can be an enormous force for good, because we are looking for, you know, people in the world who we can connect with or feel, we can feel normal because they're complicated just as we are.
I wrote a bit about this in the book, actually, about the football, which I find fascinating. So all the political journalists, obviously, most of still very male dominated, and lots of them, not all of them, massive football fans. And so Saturday, the feed switches over from what Dominic Cummings is up to what, you know, Crystal Palace or Liverpool or whoever it might be is up to. And no one seems to have a problem holding those two ideas in their head at all. I mean, without being offensive to football, you know, then it's a game.
It's trivial.
It's like, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's a leisure activity. It's something, you know, it's something you can follow incredibly obsessive and be very nerdy about. But it's no morally better than fashion. And I don't understand why we have this idea that women who are really interested in fashion and spend money on how they look are sort of frilly, you know, frilly and frivolous. And men who are really interested in football and like learn about who won the FA Cup in this year and spend, again, fortune on season tickets and replica shirts for their kids, kind of getting really rinsed by the clubs on that kind of stuff. That's fine. And I think there is a problem that stuff that is associated with women is sort of innately downgraded in that way. It's seen as being, as you say, all those emotional things we associate with women. And I think that men should be more angry about this because I think it's got really severe repercussions for them. So we know that men, for example, are much more likely to kill themselves. You know, we know that male mental health problems take a really long time to get addressed. We know that, you know, married men live longer than single women, partly because it seems that their wives nag them to go to the doctors about that strange lump rather than deciding that they're going to kind of muscle their way through it. So there are all these things that we damn women for doing. And actually, are women doing it too much or are men doing it not enough? And our model always is that because women are paid less and, you know, valued less and don't get to be in charge of stuff as much, they're, what they're doing is the wrong thing and they should change and be more like men and then they'd have more power and money and influence. And I think in the case of that opening up and talking about your feelings, talking about your ethics and your values, actually the deficit is on the male side. And I think there's been really, you know, I think it's very brave how Prince Harry has talked a lot about his mental health. Or people like, you know, Alistair Campbell have just been very open about having big periods of their life where they felt that they were kind of useless. They couldn't do anything else. John Lloyd of QI, I interviewed a couple of years ago, and he had 3 years where he said he just sat under a desk and he couldn't do anything. And he ended up reading a huge amount of stoicism, of philosophy. And that was how he managed to kind of crawl out of that hole. But you know, I think people still feel if I say something about that, then I'm going to be seen as a loon, and I'm not going to get trusted with a big proper job again. And I think that's a shame because for some of those people, that is an absolutely deadly calculation to have made. They don't seek the help that they need.
Yeah, one of the things I really loved about the book is the way you talk about that gender injustice cuts both ways. You know, in educational setup for boys and. So I'd love to hear about the book. And towards the end, you talk about it having come out of a sense, a sadness, really, or a sense of frustration. It almost felt like you wanted to fall back in love with feminism through this project. Talk to me a little bit about that impetus and why it evolved into this structure of, you know, feminism's 11 important fights.
Well, I write in the safety chapter of the book a bit about being, you know, trashed online and the experience of trying to, you know, particularly deal with the early days of Twitter when it became kind of a big mass media tool. So, I mean, Twitter founded in 2007, but I'm talking about sort of 2013 when it really became quite ubiquitous and when that was a period of quite intense feminist backlash. And feeling that, you know, it was just became incredibly unpleasant. On one side, you were getting all this abuse from, you know, presumably men, but actually probably some women as well, that was just overtly sexist and feeling that pushback. And on the other side, you were getting all this grief from people about all the ways in which you were failing, you know, to be sufficiently inclusive, in which, you know, you were overly white and middle class and heterosexual and all the kind of, you know, the stacked up identities like that. And that one was actually harder to deal with in a way. People, you know, just straightforwardly being rude about your face or telling you that you're an idiot, you kind of just have to bludgeon your way through. But the second one, you know, there is a reasonable critique there. You know, feminism has been dominated by the women at the top of the women pile, who have tended to be white, middle class and university educated and all the rest of it. And so it was a much more difficult project there to sort out what's a legitimate criticism and what is someone using the cover of legitimate criticisms to actually exercise some personal problems of their own or have a bit of a shout at someone that they just personally don't like. So those ones were quite hard to deal with. And I was quite disillusioned for a while because I thought we're not really kind of getting anywhere. And I thought, you know, in a way that feminists of the 1970s had an easier job because they were campaigning for legal reforms that were about straightforward equality. you know, just getting paid the same. And now the arguments that we're making are often much more nuanced and involve treating women specially. So we're talking about why, for example, we need to have domestic violence shelters for women. You know, there are 9 domestic violence shelters for men in Britain. It is something that there is a need for. But the dynamic overwhelmingly is of women who are killed by men. So you can't have a gender-neutral, everybody's equal approach to that problem. But that makes, you know, men defensive. That makes a lot of women kind of agree with them. You know, why are you demonizing men? And that stuff is really difficult to kind of intellectually pick your way through and make big, broad arguments about in a way that can we have the vote? You know, difficult as it was to, you know, to obtain, it's a simple argument of absolute equality, straightforward and down the line. And so I wanted to kind of deal with some of the thornier areas of contemporary feminism. And I kind of offer some hope as well, because I think, and I, you know, I've been talking a lot for the last couple of months about childcare. I don't have children myself, but I have a lot of friends who do. And in 1970, the Women's Liberation Conference in Oxfordshire said, you know, pretty much the first demand of their 5 demands was free, universal 24-hour childcare. They just thought it was the state's responsibility to make sure that, you know, women had all the support that they needed to go back to work. And I think, you know, we've kind of, because we're not so utopian now as we were then, and we've become much more accepting of the limitations of what governments can do, that's kind of drifted away. And actually, lots of women and men have ended up making a patchwork of childcare with a bit of help from the grandparents, bit of help from friends, you know, nurseries, schools when you get to that age. And the pandemic just really smashed that all up. And it became, I think, very obvious to a lot of women that when the chips were down, it was them that was, you know, whose career was expected to take the hit. And often for logical reasons, more women work part-time than men, and in straight couples, men are much more likely to be the higher earner. But they, you know, but it was a wake-up call about the fact that, you know, we still have this persistent inequality that women's lives and women's careers are inhibited by the lack of provision of really good childcare. And, you know, there are lots of women who do want, you know, to stay at home for various lengths of time. So I'm talking about there, you know, about support for women who do want to stay at home, and about maternity and particularly paternity leave, which I think is extraordinarily important. And I think it's interesting to me that my generation, I know several guys who've taken either shared parental leave or quite long paternity leaves and have got an enormous amount out of it. So, you know, it's an incredibly hard thing to have done, but their lives are so much richer as a result. And again, that comes back to what you're saying before, is that I think that feminism has a lot to offer men. I'm not sure how many men today want to live that 1950s dream where they come home and the children are ready for bed and they pat them on the head and, you know, and that's all that they see of them, and they're the breadwinner and that's what they do. They want a more balanced life. But in order to do that, they need the support of the state to be able to, you know, our jobs now are so demanding and often it's so far away from our homes, and often people's families live far away from them too, that there has to be some form of acceptance that we have to pay to help people manage that very intense part of their lives.
Yeah. There's lots of things in there I'd like to pull out. And what was clear in the book is one of the things in there is complexity, that our desire for things to be more straightforward than they are, for people to be more straightforward than they are, is hampering us because we're very black and white about things. People are either good or bad. People are either, you know, virtuous or problematic. And this sense with a kind of progressive politics that it's all moving in the same direction. And one of the cases you make again and again is that actually it's not true, that different groups with different oppressions, some of these changes do, you know, that people's rights play off each other. And that, of course, then we get onto this kind of fight or flight thing. And you talk about trashing as a thing in the 1970s, and I guess the modern equivalent is cancel culture. Where do you think we are now, over the course of having written the book, and you having gone through really, I guess, 2 waves of really significant online abuse around feminism, most recently around gender identity and trans rights? Where do you think we are? Some of your pieces seem quite reflective. You know, this is growing pains. We'll get there. Some of them don't.
I think, yeah, it's hard to keep a lid on it when you first personally feel that people are being extremely unfair to you. It's a difficult place to kind of write from. And I think there's also a tendency that, oh no, hang on, if I could just explain myself one more time, you'd understand. And actually that's, you know, what's missing is not someone presenting the arguments again. You know, sometimes people just come from a completely different place for you. They're bringing their own life experience to you. They can never meet you on that bridge in the middle. So you just become more and more frustrated as you try and explain yourself. But yeah, I think that's a very difficult thing. I think having come through the 1980s particularly, you know, I think of the film Pride as the kind of moment of this, you know, the idea of gays and lesbians support the minors. So you have everyone against the Tories, basically. So you have, you know, the kind of working, like traditional working class occupation guys and the minors. And then you have the kind of growing identity-based coalition of the 1980s of LGBT people united. And that's a wonderful story. And I think everyone kind of really wants it to be true all the time. And what the left has a problem with now is the times when that's not how it is. So, you know, for example, look at the attitudes of voters in, you know, the so-called red wall seats. They're not the attitudes of the 19-year-olds in LGBT societies in universities. So trying to keep that coalition together is much harder than it was, if it ever was easy. I mean, it's, you know, hindsight is a terrible flattener of these things. And, you know, I was just reading a piece in the New York Times last week that was about how brilliant it is that, you know, there'll be what they call fertility equality. Everyone, regardless of wealth or age or whatever, will be able to have a family. And what they meant by that was gay men engaging in commercial surrogacy. And I think when you write about that subject, you have to be pretty honest about what it entails, which is, you know, the bodies of, if you're talking about commercial surrogacy, usually poorer women being used as incubators for richer people. And, you know, particularly, you know, I think surrogacy, altruistic surrogacy, has got a lot to recommend it. I think it's a wonderful thing to do for other people. But I become very uneasy when it becomes, I have a right to have a family. And I have a right that doesn't, you know, that extends into the bodies of other people. And some of the stories about the pandemic have been absolutely heartbreaking. You know, women in the Ukraine who have gone to Northern Cyprus to have their children because Ukraine doesn't let non-straight couples use a surrogate there. So they go to an external territory, you know, have a cesarean, and then have to leave the baby there with the baby in legal limbo and return back to the Ukraine again, where this woman said at the end of this piece, you know, I keep being worried that I'm going to be arrested because I'm having, you know, my C-section scar looked at, and they're going, where's the baby? You know, they think there's something really suspicious about me. And I think, you know, if you're going to, you know, talk about these issues, it's going to be really hard because people are going to think that there's homophobia involved there. People are going to think, why don't you want gay men to have babies? You know, is this coming from a place of you're not a real family? You know, that sort of Section 28 place. And it's not, I hope. It's coming from a place of you know, your rights don't extend into other people's body. That is a negotiation that you have to make, and you have to make sure that it's fair on other people and you're not being exploitative. But it's very hard to talk about those things on the left because we want everybody to be one great, glorious alliance against a sort of cartoon version of the right. And that's not how it is very far. And trans issues are a perfect example of that. You know, there are ways in which the interests of women born female and trans women are completely aligned in regards to things like male violence. And then there are times when they might often be at odds. And because people don't want to talk about that, it's just easier to pretend that that doesn't exist. And anyone who raises it must be doing so from very bad faith motives.
I'm just going to confess my strong desire to move off the topic of trans issues, which I think almost everyone feels, because the heat and the tenor, for whatever reason, in that particular debate is currently very high, and it feels almost impossible to say anything at all without being accidentally hurtful, without just stoking something which doesn't seem to be serving the needs of anyone involved, really. But having been talking through that debate, talking about your personal experiences in the book, have you learned anything that helps?
I think the main thing you have to do if you're going to be involved in any kind of difficult conversation like that is you have to have allies, and you have to have critical friends. I have this concept that I've always meant to write a piece about and I never got around to it, which is when you become a kind of public voice, I think you should have three, you should appoint people to be three arbiters of you, a kind of ombudsman of your kind of public voice. And what I mean is by that is having three people whose judgment you respect, who you think are kind of moral and kind, and who will also not be afraid to tell you when you're being a bit of a prat. you know, they're not people who are afraid of you, you know, who will stand up to you. And having those people, even if you only internalize them and you think, what would X think about me doing this, is really useful, because you can't, you know, you can't miss out ever upsetting people, but you can ask yourself whether or not it's being done for good reasons and proportionately, and could you explain to someone else why you're doing it?
And you've talked about earlier about resentment, and I loved how honest you were in the chapter about safety when you said, I came to hate these new enemies. And how have you, if you have, maybe you still do, I wouldn't, you know, no judgment. What are the practices that you've mentioned? One, how do you stay sane in those conversations and keep writing about these things and keep telling the truth as you see it, rather than give up and run away, which I feel, often I feel those with voices in public life who are seeking to speak with integrity and from a place of kind of nuance, how do they keep going when actually this is quite personally costly?
Well, sometimes I think discretion is the better part of valor, and actually the best thing to do is not keep going. I mean, I've really limited now what, I mean, I think it's very funny you say, I don't want to talk any more about trans issues. Neither do I, really, because I agree with you. It's got to a stage where what is everyone actually now arguing about? They're not necessarily even arguing about policy changes now. They're arguing about who's had the biggest wrong done to them. And I'm not sure that's necessarily a particularly productive conversation that I can get involved in. There's no progress necessary there. It's an arbitration between people who both, you know, both sides of that debate feeling incredibly scarred and wounded. So sometimes I think that the thing to do is just recognize when you don't have anything to say, or you shouldn't really say anything. But again, in terms of resentment, I think you have to, one of the things that's quite useful is if you is asking yourself whether or not you genuinely would swap places with somebody. And quite often you'll come to the conclusion that although it looks like their life's brilliant and that everything's great for them, and, you know, why are they getting this award? Why are they getting this book deal? Why are they getting this and that and the other? That actually there's lots of things in your life that you really appreciate and love and should be a bit more thankful for. So I think that's quite a useful standard. Also, getting offline is just underrated, isn't it? I mean, people in real life don't relate to each other in the ways that they do on Facebook or Twitter or newspaper comment sections or, you know, angry Reddit posts or whatever it might be. I think the odd thing is that the internet promised us that we'd meet all these, you know, connect with all these people who are very, very different to us. And actually, I think it's ended up sorting people to spend much more time with people who are very much like them. You know, when I go and to my local cafe and I have a chat with the person behind the counter, and, you know, I'm talking about, you know, I'm slipping into a register that's very different to like me talking to lots of other people who are on the left, who are feminists, you know, who've got a whole set of assumptions, who know a whole set of vocabulary. You know, I was explaining to my family yesterday what QAnon is, and, you know, and they're all smart, you know, and working people in professional jobs who read the newspapers. And yet, you know, I've got this whole weird store of knowledge about something that I would assume that everybody knows about, right? There's loads of, and no, it's entirely possible to be a well-informed general member of society from the same demographic as me, because they're my family, and not know this. And I think that's such a healthy reminder to kind of give yourself that sense check.
Yeah. Final question, and let's ground it in feminism in the book. What is the one thing you would love to change about the way we have public conversations around feminism, around women, around equality, however you want to run with it?
I'd love to come to an answer about, and this is a mad, massive concept to introduce in the last question. So there's this idea in philosophy called standpoint epistemology, which is the idea that where you're positioned affects, you know, how you see an issue and how much you should be heard on it. So the easy way of saying this is, you know, all those op-eds you see where, like, as a mother, whatever it might be. And I think that I would love to get to a better stage where we have a much more representative media. It looks much more like the country that it's, you know, reporting on and purporting to represent. And the same thing about Parliament. And that becomes less important, because I think it's particularly acutely important now, because people are so aware that the media is all, you know, overly white and middle class and university educated and Remain voting and whatever, you know, London based and everything like that. So that there is a temptation to decide that certain people from certain identity groups are the only ones who can say certain things. And sometimes to the extent that that overrides actual evidence and fact, right? Which is not a good thing. But it's, I can understand why it's happened, and I'm sure I've ended up doing it, like playing my woman card when debates about feminism, because, you know, you feel like you're talking from a marginalized position. And I don't think we've quite got the relationship right. You know, lots of people who are in those situations feel that they're being tokenized. They're being asked to constantly speak as a minority group while, you know, white men get to talk as the voice of humanity. And I think when we get to a happier relationship between the way that personal experience can inform your worldview, but it's not actually, you know, the plural of anecdote is not data. It doesn't necessarily trump research or objective truth. And so I can see why we've ended up with the as a mother construction, but I hope that at some point there'll be enough mothers, you know, feeling that they're represented, that we don't need it anymore.
Yeah. Helen Lewis, thank you so much for speaking to me on The Sacred. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Sacred. You can find previous episodes on our website. Have a look through the back catalogue and I'm sure you'll find someone that you think sounds interesting. You can also connect with us via our social channels, and we always love hearing from you. So please keep sending in your suggestions for guests or improvement. If you value what we do, the best way you can support us is by sharing, rating and reviewing the podcast, especially on iTunes, because it really helps other people find it. The Sacred is a project of the think tank Theos, and you can find out more about our work, theosthinktank.co.uk.